go to Connor, because I want to get to Connor and this billboard first. I know he wants to talk about his agenda, but I gotta talk to him about this. I'm really excited about the news coverage. Hey, Connor, are you there?
I am, and I'm curious what agenda I have.
Well, no, talking about what you're talking about in when you were prepping me about less government and the role of conservatives with that there's no
right.
real hard line. And I think that's a great topic, and I'm happy. I'm looking forward to exploring that. But however, I love this because, like, you know, everybody knows I'm not LDS. I am just hardcore libertarian, and I think, like you do, that there are some very big areas where the Venn diagrams overlap.
Yeah.
And what I like is that you're a kindred spirit. You just take action. You do it. And the latest billboard is this one, "We are a warlike people," right?
Yeah.
Now, what I like is the timing, because it was, and again, you have to educate me a little bit, because I'm just kind of an outsider looking in, but it was General Conference weekend, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when I turned it on, it was like a news story about that, and then a news story about you, and it was like perfect timing.
Yeah, that was the timing we were hoping for, just because the traffic is so substantial during that weekend as people are coming to the conference center. Plus, it's Easter, right? I mean, the time where people focus on Christ and his message and the Prince of Peace. So really, the convergence of that was fantastic for the timing of our message, our billboard, which, for those who don't yet know, it's a statement from one of the former leaders of the church, prophet named Spencer W. Kimball. He was the prophet in the 70s. And he gave he had an article come out in the church publication that gets sent to all the members of the church who subscribe to it, at least, that basically called us and society at large idolatrous. And not that we're worshiping, you know, golden calves or anything of the like, but we're worshiping what he called gods of stone and steel. He was specifically referring to the military, or what can generally be called the military-industrial complex, the propensity to so easily go to war and bomb other people and invade and sanction and all of these war-related activities to supposedly settle international disputes. And he has a line in there where he says that we are a warlike people, that we're easily distracted, we meaning the members of the church, distracted from our assignment to build up the kingdom of God and to promote peace and basically love our enemies, as Jesus said, and bless those that curse us. So it's a stinging rebuke, or it was. This was on the 200th anniversary. It was the bicentennial of the nation. Was the setting. This is almost exactly 200 years after the Declaration of Independence. So it was there's an LDS very well known in the Mormon community, and some years after this address happened, this scholar Hugh Nibley observed in one of his articles that the Latter-day Saints, when President Kimball called us a warlike people, the Latter-day Saints largely ignored it. There was no discussion, there was no controversy, there was no change in repentance. And what Hugh Nibley says is that the Saints at that time gave President Kimball's remarks the, quote, instant deep freeze. In other words, they ignored it, right? Here's the prophet, our prophet, we believe, a man who's called of God, telling us that we're being idolatrous and that we are warlike, and we need to cut it out. And they just shelved it. They just ignored it, according to Hugh Nibley, if he's to be taken at his word. So our attempt in this project is to kind of thaw out that frozen talk and all these related messages and scriptures that support the same thing, that we should, as one of our scriptures say, renounce war and proclaim peace. So we put up a billboard. It's at exit 272 on I-15, which is the Orem 800 North exit. So as you're driving south on I-15, you'll see it on your right, just after the 800 North Orem exit, and it just says, you know, why did Spencer W. Kimball say, and then in big words, big letters, we are a warlike people, find out at, and then the website is warlikepeople.com. And there we have the address, we have a large excerpt, and we link to it in full. We have many addresses from other church leaders on the same topic. We have scriptures as well. There's no editorialization. We have an explicit disclaimer on there, excuse me, that this isn't about a political party. It's not about a candidate. This isn't about Mitt Romney. This is
a much bigger,
broader thing.
About peace, essentially.
It's about peace. It's about a very fundamental moral question. People say, oh, you're mixing politics and religion. This isn't politics. This is basic morality. When is it right to harm and kill other people? This isn't like, should we do the flat tax or the fair tax? You know, this isn't just some mundane political question of relatively benign importance. This is a very basic and essential moral question. And it was, I think, when President Kimball gave the address. So our attempt here is to not editorialize, not suggest that the libertarian or libertarian-leaning foreign policy must be followed, every jot and tittle of it. It's rather to bring up these talks that the saints have ignored or frozen, as Hugh Nibley said, and to generate conversation, to get people to look at that and assess, you know, were these leaders right? Are these scriptures? Do they mean what they mean on their face, that we should renounce war and proclaim peace? How am I doing? How are we collectively doing? Let's talk about it. Let's not shelve it. Let's look at the wars that we've been in and the money we've spent, the people we've killed, our own soldiers who have died. Is it worth it? Are we turning the other cheek? Are we being good Christian people, or are we being idolatrous?
I think this is important, if I remember right, you know, I spent a lot of time on Facebook. I am a nerd, I admit it, and I saw some posts that you had made, and I'm not implying if you, because I think you spent a lot of time, I'm not implying any nerddom here, Connor, but I did see something that was interesting, and whether it's cosmic or there's cause and effect at play, I don't know, but it seemed to be that these were some of the talking points actually that came up during this conference. Is that right?
There were some related ones. I wouldn't say dead on, but yeah, there were some great related messages in general conference. And it's really not cosmic or coincidental or that we prompted it or anything. It's that this is stuff that's being taught all the time, but people just kind of selectively pick and choose and don't really question their support of foreign policy because it's so constant and at times subtle. So there's no really fiery anti-war sermons being preached from our pulpits right now, but there simply is a basic message of peace and love and friendship and harmony, and that happens all the time. It's a basic, essential part of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So you really can't listen to, you know, any sermon in general without at least finding something related to this question of peace and morality. And so it's merely our attempt to kind of, you know, we put it, of course, in Orem, where there's a really high concentration of Latter-day Saints. It's got a great location on the side of the freeway, very close, very low, very easy to see. And so we really just want to generate discussion. We're a peaceable people. We're not pacifists. I mean, most of the people involved in the project have tons of guns and, you know, totally support, rightly so, self-defensive actions, and a defensive war would be appropriate. But none of these wars we've been in recently are defensive, and we believe that we collectively, and you know, Latter-day Saints especially, have strayed from this basic Christian message of peace. And so our desire is really to just generate discussion on the topic. We've succeeded. I mean, we've already got tons of people talking about it, and that's a good thing. But we don't want just chatter. We want lasting change. We want people to become converted to the message of peace and to demand that, you know, the politicians act likewise. So we're in this for the long haul. We had the Bomb Iran billboard a couple months ago. We've got this one now. There will be other projects in the future, but we're hopeful to change minds and persuade people in the long term.
All right, come on. This is great. And when we come back after the break, we're going to talk to Connor, talk about actually what he wants to talk today about in the Boyack Review, and that is this soft line that seems to be what a conservative is all about. Come on back, guys.
The Voice of Utah. AM 630 K-Talk.
K-Talk.com.
Number one for the most live, local, two-way talk.
All right, guys, welcome back. Mental Self-Defense Radio. I am Jake Shannon in the middle of the Boyack Review here. Every Tuesday, we got Connor Boyack with us. Connor, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, so you messaged me earlier the topic of your talk, and it's this kind of fuzzy line about what it means to be a conservative. Explain a little bit for people who, you know, don't know what you mean.
You know, I think one of the challenges we face, especially here in Utah, is that so many people self-identify as conservatives. And at times I do, depending on the audience and the circumstances. But I think largely conservatism has become so widely applied that it lacks any concise definition. And, you know, I often get a good kick out of, in discussions with people, someone who self-identifies in this way, asking them, what does conservatism mean to you? What does it mean to be conservative? And the answers are pretty interesting. Generally, in my experience, it has been a very relativistic definition. And by that I mean there's no hard lines that they draw. It's a very relative thing. As an example, they say, you know, less taxes or limited government or more freedom, and it's all these less and mores and less and mores. And it's, you know, for example, FreedomWorks, which has kind of made a name for itself here in Utah, as great as they are, I agree with them on a lot of what they do. But their slogan is lower taxes, less freedom. Sorry, less government, more freedom.
Yeah, yeah. They stole the old Libertarian Party.
Right.
It's the exact same tagline. I'm surprised the LP didn't sue them, but the LP changed theirs. But yeah, I get you totally.
Well, and it's something that kind of certainly if you explain it a bit more, it can have its own substance. But I think it's problematic to have basically your core policy, your core definition, your identity of an ideology like conservatism be tied explicitly in that way to relative terms. You know, less government, but less than what? I mean, are we talking less than what was there in 1787? Or are we talking, you know, less government than the Third Reich under Hitler? You know, because as government centralizes and increases over time, less is always going to be different. It's like when, you know, Obama is asking for budget cuts, for example, or when the Republican candidates, save Ron Paul, are saying that they're going to make cuts here, there, and this other part of the budget, they're not actually cuts; they are just reductions in the increases. And so it's extremely dangerous to tie our ideology, and thus our political support of the various issues or candidates or policies. It's dangerous to tie that to relativism. Because the general trend of government, as Jefferson said, is for government to increase and liberty to decrease. And so as government increases, as the power centralizes, if by saying we're conservative, we agree with lower taxes and less government, there is no firm line in the sand. There is no ability to protest on principle and say, wait a minute, you've gone too far. There's a great book by a man who passed away I think several years ago, whose books are fantastic. His name is H. Berlin Anderson. And he's LDS, and so he's got some Mormon stuff weaved into it, but he does fantastic at just enunciating the basic principles of philosophy of law and the morality of what government is and ought to be. I want to read a portion of this because I think it's so awesome and shows a distinct contrast with what I'm talking about in terms of conservatism being relative. He says that one who knows not what his rights are can never know when they are taken and is unable to defend them. He's like a man who believes that he owns a piece of ground, which his neighbor also claims, but he doesn't know its boundaries. The neighbor then continues to encroach further and further onto land he suspects is his, but since he's never certain where the boundary is, he cannot check the advance. Until he takes a firm position and says, this far and no further, there is no line. And I love how he says that because, you know, we have specific boundaries around our natural rights, our unalienable rights. And if we don't know what those boundaries are, then when the government restricts those liberties, encroaches upon them as inevitably occurs, then how do we check the advance? How do we resist the encroachment if we don't know where that line is? If we have clung to an ideology that is based in relative terms and just says, oh, we want less government, then as government increases by 10% each year, just as a simplistic example, and we want 3% reductions, we're basically justifying the 7% increase on an annual basis. We are permissively accepting an increase in government, or in other words, a violation of the very thing, less government, we claim to want. And so without having firm lines in the sand, as most libertarians, I think, generally tend to do better than any other ideology, is to draw those boundaries, is to recognize the violation of a principle, is to reject the encroachment of your rights in whatever example we could list. Libertarians, I think, do far better than many because they recognize the principle and therefore recognize and then reject the violation of that principle. Conservatives, generally, I don't think they are as good as recognizing those violations because they haven't drawn a line in the sand. They're relativistic in saying, well, you know, for example, Senator Jim DeMint, he says, you know, less government and more freedom. But that's always relative based on the circumstances in which you live. What he supports now under the banner of less government and more freedom, as an example, would be far different than what he would if he were born 150 years ago before the Progressive Era, when there were more freedoms and more liberties and less government. Then, in those times, less government, more freedom would mean something completely different because of the different nature of the government in those days and the different status, the you know, increased liberties back then, saying more freedom would mean more than the more freedom than we have now. It's a very confusing thing, and I think that's why conservatives, at least one reason why so many conservatives have a hard time at articulating exactly what government should do or where a violation of the rights exists, because they've kind of at least subconsciously tolerated or fully embraced this this steady encroachment of their rights. As H. Berlin Anderson said, as I just read in his book, that he doesn't know where his boundary is, and so the neighbor, the government, continues to encroach further and further, but that individual, the conservative, cannot take the firm position and say this far and no further. I think we need to help conservatives be a bit more consistent and understand both what the principle is and what the boundary around that is, so that they can, with us, object to the encroachment across that boundary and start to push back against the government. Until and unless that happens, the government is just going to continue to grow, and we're going to object, but only in degrees, not in substance, not in absolutes, but we want less than, you know, the massive encroachment. We want a little bit less, and over time, that encroachment continues to erode our liberties to an increasing degree. That, I think, is the basic problem of conservatism, is its relative nature.
Well, you've stumbled onto something that this is why I don't call myself a conservative, among others. But the real driver for me personally was, you know, you were mentioning these other authors, and I think this is, you know, it's kind of like how Leibniz and Newton stumbled on calculus independently at the same time. Back in the early 60s, my favorite Austrian economist, F.A. Hayek, he wrote a book called The Constitution of Liberty, and in that he had an essay called Why I Am Not a Conservative. Mm-hmm. And it's this exact same point, that when you have a progressive, which is where, you know, where we are, that keeps growing government in the scope and turning negative liberties into positive, you know, really focusing on positive liberties instead of negatives,
right?
You end up growing and growing, and the conservative isn't offering a viable alternative. They're just slowing down the progress. So you're going to end up at the same place. There, it's just a conservative is just putting on the brakes, but you're still moving towards that area. And that's why Hayek said, look, I am not a conservative. Don't call me a conservative. I am a classical liberal, which essentially is what a libertarian means today. And that is a whole different alternative. I am not trying to slow down any progress at all. As a matter of fact, libertarians are very progressive in the sense that they're open-minded and they're open to new experiences and integrating new knowledge, but not progressive in the size, in the idea of growing the state or anything like that. And I think this is the very same concept.
I really like what you mentioned. It reminded me of something that Murray Rothbard wrote, that in one of his histories, he talks about the old right. Basically, when the early conservatism, modern conservative movement got started, and he basically makes the case that they didn't want to conserve anything. They wanted to repeal and dismantle. They started during the era of the New Deal. It was this weird faction across political lines made up of people from different parties and ideologies who opposed, you know, he says that the minimum demand, which almost all of the old right agreed on, which virtually defined the old right, was total abolition of the New Deal, the whole kit and caboodle of the welfare state, the Wagner Act, the Social Security Act, going off gold in 1933, and all the rest. Rothbard makes the case that conservatism back in the day wasn't about conserving anything. It was objecting to the violation of the rights, or as Hayek said, that you just referenced, of going back to classical liberalism, rejecting the violation of property, life, liberty, and property. And so it's really interesting that, you know, people today say, well, conservatism means conserving. We want to conserve the Republic and the Constitution and our liberty. But we've so changed definitions over time of what conservatism is, because as Rothbard notes, back in the day, it wasn't really taken that way. It was an objection to the violation of rights by the progressives and these, you know, FDR and his cronies who were putting this stuff into place. So today, we find conservatives who have totally altered the very definition of their own movement and their own party, and they are trying to conserve things, but as you mentioned, at a slower rate than the increase of government, and so they're simply trying to slow down the growth rather than working to reverse the growth and to counteract that trend. That, I think, is a struggle that conservatives deal with, is realizing that that's really unacceptable if we really want to conserve or, you know, restore the Constitution and our natural rights. Conservatism, I think, is an ineffective vehicle largely only because it does not have a cohesive definition. It does not have, general understanding of what it is and is meant to be, because it's changed definitions, and even, you know, 10 conservatives can't really agree on what it means, and even if they were to kind of agree, it would largely be on these relative terms that I'm talking about, that they simply want less of one thing and more of another. We need people, I think, who are standing up in kind of a Tom Paine fashion or Patrick Henry, or, you know, these guys who recognize the violation and vociferously object to the violation. Not that they want kind of a more gentle encroachment of their rights, you know, or something that's not as harsh or quick or expensive or what have you. They recognized the violation and wanted to reject it completely. As Rothbard notes, that was the same thing with the genesis of the modern conservative movement. So largely today, they've strayed from what it was intended to be, what it originally was, and that was repeal and dismantle. It was not to simply tweak and slow down the bad stuff.
Yeah, I think this is an important point. I sometimes feel like I'm just hitting my head against a brick wall, though, sometimes here in Utah. I mean, you know, people call themselves conservative and walk out of these caucuses voting for Hatch and, you know, and then supporting Romney.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't get it. And I mean, I think it's a noble pursuit. I am here every day doing this. I love the kind of thing you're doing to educate people. But boy, sometimes it's
battle.
A little tough. I mean, you've got, like, for example, going to this billboard, you got some feedback. I'm sure you got great feedback, but you also got feedback that challenged you too, supposedly from a conservative.
Yeah, well, and you know, the thing that I've always said, the biggest problem of our day, and I still stand by this, is inconsistency. It's a really unique situation. Living in Utah, predominantly Latter-day Saint population, what I've found as a Latter-day Saint is that people kind of intuitively understand and agree with the Constitution, even if there's differing interpretations or they're not quite applying it the same way. At least there's kind of this subconscious recognition and reverence for freedom and liberty. And I think that the thing that we have to do is show where that inconsistency exists. That says, well, you agree with, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but look how you're supporting this policy that's violating it, and here's why it violates it. And it's bridging that gap on the inconsistency where someone agrees with this fundamental principle, even if they haven't even articulated maybe the principle, but they agree with just kind of the very basics of it. It's illustrating that inconsistency and helping them bridge the gap and correct themselves. But I think I've always said we have fertile ground here because of that. So many people who understand these things kind of intuitively, even if there are many of them, and many of them, you know, are, as you mentioned, I've been getting these emails from some people who are very vocal in their, you know, disdain for what we're doing, even though the things that they're arguing against are completely wrong. They have it all wrong. I'll agree with you that it is an uphill battle, and some days seem harder than the rest.
Hey, well, keep up the fight, Connor. Really awesome to see all over the news. And a great point about really thinking hard about what does it mean to be a conservative. It's almost, when you look at it, it is relativism. Connor, appreciate it, man. See you next Tuesday. Guys, we will be back tomorrow. More Mental Self-Defense Radio here on